irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world, and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and if you're a regular listener, thank you for joining me once again. And if this is your first time, please make yourself at home as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and caring authors who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, our topic today is it's a very serious topic, and it's one that I actually just came back from a three-day seminar in which this topic was discussed quite a bit. So let me start out by just giving you some statistics. 350 million people worldwide suffer from depression, and this is known as the silent epidemic. Suicide is the third leading cause of death in the U.S. behind cancer and heart disease. And yet we still don't address the possible reasons and cures for depression the way we do these other diseases. Well, the time has come for this to change. And one surprisingly delightful way to delve into this difficult topic is to hear the heartbreakingly beautiful and happy ending story of a girl and her healing, loving, ever-accepting dog named Bunker, the dog who saved her life. Our guest today, Julie Barton, is a writer, mother of two, and animal lover. Her memoir, Dog Medicine, How My Dog Saved Me From Myself, was published last November by Think Peace Publishing. Julie has a BA in English Literature from Kenyon College and an MFA in Writing from Vermont College of Fine Arts and a Master's in Women's Studies from Southern Connecticut State University. Julie's writings have been published in Brainchild Magazine, the South Carolina Review, Louisiana Literature, Two Hawks Quarterly, Westview, the Huffington Post, and many more that It would take up too much of the show to try to name them all. But mostly, she tells me, she just tries to be kind to people and animals, avoid judgment, appreciate nature, and write every chance she gets. Julie, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much, Alan. Thank you for having me.
Well, I have enjoyed reading the book as a dog lover and one who has three running around the house right now. It's very, very heartfelt to read it. I think it's a beautiful story, and the way that you talk about your love of animals and in the book you talk a lot about that as well as about nature. Now, even as a child, do you think that this innate ability to connect with the natural world around you, did this make your special connection with Bunker possible, or do you think this is something that most anybody can have that same type of connection?
Well, that's a great question. I part of me does believe that everybody can make that kind of connection, but you really do have to be able to open up and forget everything you know. And listen. And that was the thing that I did as a kid. You know, when things were rough in my house, I would go with the dog to my room, or I would go outside and I would wander around in the woods and near a pond near our house and just sit and be. And when I did that, I noticed that there was a lot of beauty and rhythm and acceptance in nature that I didn't necessarily feel everywhere else or with human beings. I felt it with animals and with being outside. And so when I got to be in my early 20s and life got really hard, returning to that place really saved me, and I'm glad I remembered. It's easy to forget, you know, the things we know as kids before we get I don't know what the word is, infiltrated by the world. They're wiser than we know, and so returning to that place was a really smart move in a desperate time that I'm glad I made.
Now, in the book, you talk about seeing the world through Bunker's eyes, his sort of hopeful puppy wonder. How did learning to treat Bunker with kindness and gentle understanding teach you how to treat yourself better?
Yeah. Well, you know, so I don't know if listeners know about the story, but, you know, it starts out when I was in my early 20s, and I had basically what I called, I don't really know what it even really was a breakdown of some sort. It was a depressive breakdown. And I had been depressed for a long time, but I didn't know what it was. This was 1996. And nobody really talked about depression as a disease then. I just thought there was something wrong with me because I was weak and dumb. And when I went home, I was living in Manhattan, and I went home, and my family really tried to intervene and help me, and nothing helped until I adopted this dog. And yes, you know, when I had a responsibility, I had something to take care of, I had something that was fragile and needed me and trusted me to do what was best for him, it was most certainly a lesson in, wow, that's not at all how I treat myself, most particularly within my own mind. For me, depression came about because of a long-standing and invisible to me cycle of really negative thoughts, that everything I did was wrong and stupid and nobody liked me. And those were things that I deeply believed, and it's taken decades to unlearn. And I didn't know that I believed that, and I didn't notice that I thought that until I was nearly dead, ready to take my own life. And, you know, I think it's not uncommon, you know, and we try so hard to get through, just to make it through. Life is hard enough. And I think that a lot of people are suffering and are afraid to say how deeply they're suffering or how much they fear or how sad they are because of judgment or shame or, you know, they need to keep their job or there's many, many reasons why we can't, you know, really say our truths. But it's so important. It's so important because depression is unfortunately all too often a lethal disease. And the good news is it's treatable. It really is. We just have to learn to take care of ourselves. And so, yeah, having this dog showed me how to remember how to do that, you know, and how to have sort of softness with myself and to laugh again and to take care of myself because, you know, I knew how to take care of him. I knew what he needed, and I knew that I could give that to him. And then in doing that, in training him and in feeding him and walking him and playing with him, I felt good about it because I thought I'm succeeding at something because I hadn't succeeded at anything in a really long time. And, you know, when you give a dog love, they give it back to you about 100-fold. Mm-hmm. So that didn't hurt either.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think that at that time was part of it the stigma of depression? Was part of it that you weren't asking for help from adults, or was it that you were asking and the responses that you were getting were not helping?
Well, you know, I didn't know what depression was. I'd never heard of it. I mean, you know, I'd heard of the term like oh, I'm so depressed, as in, like, I'm having a bad day. I didn't know what depression, the disease, was until I'd been given the diagnosis. And I felt enormously ashamed of it. And it was because I'd never known anybody in the mid-90s who had been diagnosed with this, who had been, you know, told you need to take, you know, brain-altering medication because you're so sick with this disease. I felt a lot of shame about it. And the blessing that I had was that my parents, despite them not knowing what it was either, especially, you know, my dad was very quick to say, this is chemistry. This is brain chemistry. You know, there's a lot that we can do, but a lot of this is just like, you know, say you have diabetes, say you have, you know, an immune system problem. This is something that is we can treat. And, you know, both of my parents really worked hard to get me to the place where I did not think that I was broken or, you know, sick, that just that this was something that I had and is treatable. But I do think that, you know, when I came home from New York, you know, we didn't know what was going on before I got the diagnosis and before we realized how bad it was. I had to get pretty far down into a very dangerous state before we really realized, okay, this needs medical attention. And I don't think it was because of inattention at all. I think it was because we just didn't know. We thought, wow, that was a really rough year in New York. New York is a tough place to live, especially for a, you know, struggling, just graduated from college young woman who also had a boyfriend that she broke up with, and life is hard, and that was a rough year. And that was what we thought, and I'll go home and regroup. But it turned out to be a lot more than that. And so, you know, it was 20 years ago. Uh-huh. And, you know, I'm really, really grateful for how the adults in my life handled it, because they took me seriously. Uh-huh. They listened. They got me the help that I needed. They reminded me that there's no shame in asking for help. In fact, it's essential. And I've taken that with me throughout my life. And they also accepted into their home this puppy, this chewing, pooping, peeing, crazy at times puppy into their home. And that was the biggest gift they could have ever given me, was letting that happen.
Well, that's it. I mean, and it's beautiful that you had such great support. And I think part of the struggle is that, you know, we're raised here in the United States, and, you know, for the most part, most of us can say that we have access to most anything we want. We have access to great education. We have access to a lot of things that people don't have in other parts of the world. And I know that when I've been in other parts of the world, I've heard people say, so tell me how it is that these Americans can be depressed when they have everything. And so I think that if that's instilled upon us enough, and would you agree that's sort of the mentality, you know, how could you be depressed? You have everything. Is that maybe one of the reasons why it becomes something that we are ashamed of, or something that we don't share with others?
Yeah, well, you know, the funny thing is that depression is not an economic issue. I mean,
exactly.
It can be,
exactly.
But some of the wealthiest people I know are some of the most depressed, and some of the, you know, like most working class people who are struggling day by day are the happiest people I know, because it comes down to support and community and self-love and group, you know, love among your family, and that's what staves off depression. It doesn't have anything to do with what we have or what we acquire, or, you know, it does, you know, diet and things like that do help. But, you know, when it comes to saying, people in America, how are you so depressed when you have everything? You know, that's the thing. Depression is not staved off by a new car. Ever. No, that might be one of our problems as a society, is that we think it might be. It's not.
Right.
It's not where joy lies.
Exactly. And I think you've touched on so many great things, as you said, like community. Because again, in being in third world countries, you know, I've been around kids that are playing soccer in bare feet on gravel and running and playing and laughing and just having the greatest time. And I know that when they're done, they're going to some shack somewhere, you know, where they're going to go live or go eat. Mm-hmm. And they're just as happy as they could possibly be. So, yes,
absolutely.
I think it's important that you bring up all of those points, as well as that point of there's a chemical change that happens that we cannot control. I think that's
right.
So great that message gets out there. Now, the story, again, the book, and I highly recommend it to everybody out there, and it doesn't, you don't need to be going through depression to read this book. You don't even need to know somebody that's going through depression to read this book. It's a very, very personal story. And at times you talk about some very dark things. I mean, was it difficult to go back to that place when you sat down and were going through the writing process?
You know, it's interesting. A lot of people ask that, and no, it wasn't difficult, because I think that I'm the kind of person, it's difficult things live with me until I work all the way through them. And so by the time I was writing the story, I could tell it from a place of, you know, of a little bit of distance and understanding too. There wasn't pain in writing it, because I knew that my mission was to say, you know, this was what happened, and yes, it was hard, and yes, I got through it, and here's how. So no, it wasn't particularly painful to recall. And I think that, you know, I think a lot of people who are drawn to writing memoir feel that way. They want to process. They want to work through what happened. They want to understand on a really deep level, you know, what happened, and many, many layers of what happened and why, and also, you know, what came of this? What came of what happened to you as a kid or as a young adult, or, you know, in your family line that you're carrying? And one of the ways to sort of change the cycle or get, you know, the next generation to sort of move along is to really process it. And so it wasn't particularly painful. I mean, there were most certainly days I cried as I wrote, but often it was a joyful thing. I mean, that was what was so interesting, is that I found myself most often in tears when I was writing about how incredibly grateful I was that my mom got in the car and drove straight 9 hours from Ohio to New York, picked me up literally, put me in the car and took me home. Or, you know, my dearest friend, who I had been a terrible friend to, forgave me and was there for me. And of course, writing about Bunker, this dog who saved my life, writing about those things that were so full of love, and I'm so full of gratitude for them. Those were the times that I cried. And so I think when I was writing, when I would shed the most tears, it was in a really beautiful way, in a, oh my gosh, isn't life astounding way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and although Bunker gets a lot of credit in the book, you know, as you're saying now, it is a real joint effort. You know, when you mentioned earlier about as far as community and loved ones and friends and family, and everybody sort of rallying to your support, recognizing and just showing their love, which is beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that I learned that in writing this book and in growing up, you know, is that as much as my family may be flawed, because every single family is flawed no matter what. That's just how we are. They absolutely showed up for me and did their very best for me. And that's all you can ask for. I mean, that to me is the perfect family. The family that is flawed and troubled at times and messes up sometimes, but shows up and does their very best despite all of that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think also, I mean, it's, you know, what do you focus on? If you start from the standpoint, as you said, where all families are flawed and all humans are flawed. So that would suggest that all families are flawed. But what do you focus on? If you focus on those flaws, you're never going to appreciate or have the gratitude for these types of things you're discussing, of them being there for you, of them driving 9 hours, of having a complete forgiveness and not focusing on whatever that flaw was that you had that caused a bit of a riff.
And to be clear, you know, I was not always that way at all. You know, there were years where I was really angry and wanted to distance myself. And I think that that's part of growing up in a way. I think that that's a natural process for a child, and growing into an adult is, you know, pulling away and looking and being critical. And, you know, I wasn't always looking at my family in the way that I do now, because I had to sort of shed that skin of being a child and growing up. And, and I had a lot of anger and sorrow and disappointment, but, you know, I think that everybody does. You can't be born into a group of people who are flawed when we are flawed and not have some disappointment and have some frustration and have some sorrow and anger. But, you know, at the end of the day, when you look at, for me, when I've looked at who showed up for me and who's always there for me, who's the first person I want to call, you know, aside from my husband, it's my mom and dad. And so, you know, it's not as if I was always looking on the bright side, for sure. I was a pretty dark young person. And I think that that's part of my growth process.
Well, for anybody out there, if you would like to sort of follow along with us a little bit, you can go to Julie's website. And if you go to buyjuliebarton.com, if you go to the website, the first thing you see is a picture, and I assume that's of Bunker. Uh-huh. And all you have to do is look in those eyes. When you look in those eyes of that picture, on the cover of the book, you just melt. I mean, whatever it is that's bothering you, you look in those eyes and they're so telling. There's so much love in that picture. I love it. So again, for anybody out there, if you want to just, you know, open up another window on your computer and pull that up while you're listening to us, I think that'll help put you in that feeling of love that, you know, that Julie got from Bunker at the time in which she needed him most.
Yeah. Those eyes, I mean, people are just, they're so soulful. And, you know, the story behind that photo too is I hired a woman named Bev Sparks in Seattle when I was living there for a photo shoot with him. And I've carried around this 4x6 print for 20 years. And we managed to scan it, and it still looks, this is not a digital photo. This is not from some photo shoot recent. This is from a 1999 or maybe 2000 photo shoot. And it's a print, and I mean, I've carried it with me all these years, and we managed to make a pretty nice book cover out of it. But yeah, those eyes are part of this incredible, incredible creature. I mean, he wasn't healing just for me. He was healing for a lot of people along the way. And what's been beautiful about the book coming out is that people are writing to me and saying, "Oh my gosh, me too. This is my story. Thank you so much for writing it. I thought I was the only crazy dog person." There's a lot of us out there.
So, I mean, share with those that have not had this experience, some of the things that expressed Bunker's love that helped you heal in that way that no human relationship was able to do.
Yeah. Well, so the first time I knew that I had a companion and a healer and somebody to be with me by my side through my next chapter of my life was a few days after I got him. And the first day I got him, I was so excited that I felt great. And the next morning I woke up, and it was the first morning in my life that I remember waking up feeling hope. And what I mean by that is that I think a lot of people who suffer from depression know this. When you wake up, it can be the hardest moment of the day because you don't want that day. Mm-hmm. You just wake up, and it's not even a thought. It's a feel. It's just a there. You don't want that day. And for the first time in my memory, I noticed that that feeling was gone. And it actually was the first time I even noticed that it was there because it was gone. I mm-hmm. didn't even notice it until it had disappeared. And so those first few days were great. And then about the third or fourth day that I had him, I started to sink again. And I started to feel sorrow and think, oh my gosh, it's coming back. There's nothing, nothing's going to help me. And I went and sat on my parents' couch, and I put my face in my hands. And I just began to go back to that place of such deep sorrow. And also, honestly, it was a place that I was very comfortable in, very familiar with. I knew depression very well. And in a way, I was relieved to go back there because the other way of living was unknown. Mm-hmm. And so I sat on my couch, and Bunker walked over to me. He noticed, first of all, which was huge, and he walked mm-hmm. over to me, and he sat on my feet. And he leaned against my shins, and he turned his head and looked at me, and it was like he was like, "Did that help? Is that a little better now?" Mm-hmm. And that alone was enough to make me think, "All right, I'm being seen right here, and I don't know if I'm making this up or not, but I need to believe in something, and I'm going to believe in this dog." And he never once let me down, and one of the beautiful things about having a dog when you are suffering in these deep psychological ways is that they notice, they're extraordinarily perceptive and sensitive, and they will come up to you and mirror you. You know, they'll come over and they'll lean against you and kind of touch you in a way that's soft and gentle. Mm-hmm. Or even sometimes they'll just come over and be goofy and pull you out a little bit. But also, they don't ask you to explain what's going on. They don't say, "What's wrong? Are you okay?" You know, which brings, you know, even the most well-meaning friend or family member who comes up to you and says that, there's a lot of baggage brought along with that when that question is being asked. Dogs don't have language, and that's one of their biggest gifts, is that you don't have to explain to them what's going on. You don't have to say, "I'm having a bad day, leave me alone." Uh-huh. Because they don't require it. All they require is a connection. And that can, there's something really, basic and beautiful and comforting about that. That is it's a place that I accessed thousands of times in my life with Bunker. When I was feeling down, he knew, and he would come from across the house and find me. In fact, I have some video footage of him doing exactly that, because I was keeping a video journal and I was talking about something and I started to cry, and you can see you can see his little head poke around the corner, kind of like, "You okay?" You know? Mm-hmm. And I counted on it, and it just brought me out enough that I was able to sort of stop and notice. And that's one of the biggest pieces of dealing with my depression and living with it, is noticing my thoughts and going, "Okay, is that really true? Is it really true that just because I made that mistake, I'm a dumb person, or I can't do anything right?" No, that's not really true. And part of the way that dogs help us notice is they help us sort of slow down and enjoy this moment. Mm-hmm. This one right here, where we're petting them, or where we're clipping on the leash, or and going for a walk, and there's no underestimating the power of slowing down and noticing, and then for me, because he was so kind and gentle and you know, Buddha-like, it forced me to be kind of kind and gentle and slow with myself, because I wanted to be that way with him, so in a way I mirrored him. And then, you know, I know that you've read the book, and the people mm-hmm. who haven't, there comes a time when, you know, Bunker's life was in jeopardy, and I thought, if I lose this dog, I'm not going to make it, and so it forced me to do something big, and try to save his life. And that doing that and having the gumption to be like, nothing is going to stop me from trying to save this dog, helped me feel like I had strength and I had, you know, motivation, and I could do something really hard and scary. So.
Okay. Yeah. So it helped you build confidence, in your own ability, which is great. Now, and I realize that no dog will be able to replace Bunker, but I know you currently have a dog named Jackson. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, he's lying asleep right next to me right now. He just turned around and looked at me. He is a rescue. We're his fourth home. He is a, terrier mix, and he is so different from Bunker. But the thing that I've learned is that, you know, life kind of brings you what you need when you need it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he, I think, emotionally probably needed us more than we needed him. And we had the capacity to bring him in, and we've had him for, I think, 7 years now. And I think he's finally realizing he's not going anywhere. And he's really relaxing, and he's snuggling, and he's sweet. But he's wild, and he's nothing like Bunker. I mean, he take him to the dog park, and he takes off like a shot. I mean, people call him Action Jackson because he's crazy. Mm-hmm. but he's also sweet and loving, and he has a little bit of, you know, every dog has a little bit of, I don't know, doggy Buddha in them, where they have a bit of wisdom. I think all animals do.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
I think that, yeah, they have a, that they use, because they don't have speech as we know it, I think they use their other senses, their sense of smell, or just their sense of feeling what it is that you're feeling at that time, because they've needed these things. You know, if you're a dog, and if your lineage goes back to the wild, there were a lot of bigger animals that preyed on you, so you had to know what is safe and what isn't safe, you know, and such. So yeah, I completely agree. Now we're going to take a break. It'll be about a minute and 15 seconds. This will give everybody a chance to go out and give your pet a big hug. And come right back. The subject is Dog Medicine, How My Dog Saved Me From Myself. Our guest is Julie Barton, and you're listening to Answers for the Family. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our guest today is Julie Barton, and the subject is dog medicine. But it's more than just that, because we're talking about depression, and we're talking about one aspect of being able to help you get through that. There's obviously a lot more. There's community and everything else that we all need to help get through this. Now, Julie, I know you mentioned that your newest dog, Jackson, is a rescue. Our dogs are also rescues. And I think that that's important. There's so many dogs out there. And I know that we had two at one time. One of them just passed away about a year and a half ago from old age. And the remaining one was heartbroken. And I realized that his name is Kirby. And he's a Blue Heeler Terrier. And he's now 12 years old. And all of a sudden I started to see him what appeared to be depressed. And he got old really fast. And so we went out and I talked to some people in the industry, and they said, don't rush too fast. Spend more time with him. Let him grieve a little bit. But then we started going out to other rescue centers, and we would take Kirby with us, and we would go into that special area where they allow you to let let a dog run free and see how it's going to work with you. But we weren't looking for how it worked with us. We wanted to see how the new dog worked with Kirby. And we tried with different dogs. And then all of a sudden with Maya, and Kirby's 30 pounds. Maya's 100-pound black German Shepherd. And at the time was only under a year old. And she ran in. And she looked at the situation, and she ran in, and she kind of nuzzled me, and she nuzzled my girlfriend, and she nuzzled my son, and then she looked over at Kirby and went over and just kind of got next to him, and then she got really, really low on the ground, like, let's play. But she got down at eye level with him, and they started playing. And they haven't stopped since. And Kirby got young. Kirby got young again. And we now have another two-year-old in the house as well, a two-year-old dog. And Kirby is a third the weight of the other two dogs. The other two are females. He's a male. He runs the house. It is so cute. But we go to the dog park every morning that's right down the street. And all the dogs there know that don't mess with the two big dogs, because that little one over there is their protector. It's a beautiful thing.
I love that. Well, and that's the story about when Maya found you guys. That was how it was with Bunker. I was looking at different litters, and I went to this little farm in rural Ohio, and he walked up to me, and he was extraordinarily calm, and he just sat down and looked up into my eyes, and I was like, okay, that's it. And it did feel like he was like, there you are.
Yeah, he picked you. I've been
waiting for you. Yeah, he did.
You didn't pick him, he picked you.
Exactly, and that's what I tell people. When you're looking for a dog, just wait for the spark. Just wait. Mm-hmm. Well, it'll come.
Yeah, well. That's exactly it is for us. We know that Maya picked us, but then Kirby was still the final decision, so Kirby picked Maya. So it was.
Love it. Yeah.
We didn't have a lot to say in it. I know that that you donate 5% of your profits, from the first year of your book's release to what the Wonder Dog Rescue. Tell us a little bit about Wonder Dog and why this particular rescue is important to you.
Well, Wonder Dog Rescue is a small rescue organization in San Francisco, and they rescue smaller dogs. Jackson's about 22 pounds. And they go around. There's so many rescues like this, and it was really hard to pick, but I figured since we got Jackson from there that we would support the people who rescued him. But they go around to the high kill shelters and to some of the, you know, pounds, and they pull out the dogs that are in the most need. And often Wonder Dog will find, you know, they found a tiny chihuahua who had, her ears were, you know, she had a terrible skin immune deficiency, and her ears were crusty, and she was miserable, and she was just shaking, and they took her and got her, and they got her the help she needed, you know, and mm-hmm. and so, you know, there's got to be a way to thank people that do that, and so that's what we did.
Definitely. So, and I was just checking on the time. So let's go back. Let's talk a little bit more about depression itself. Now, you know, I know that a depression diagnosis can fluctuate, and it can certainly change over time. How have you dealt with the depression now as you've gotten into adulthood? You know, has it gotten easier? Has it gotten more difficult? You know, are you... is it just something that is more managed? Have you needed to add, is there medication that helps balance you? How have you mm-hmm. dealt with it over now 20 years?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it's not as if I got a dog and suddenly my life was easy and better. So I got on medication pretty quickly after my diagnosis, and it definitely helped. But medication doesn't help everybody, and I would caution people to just try medication right away. I don't really like how primary care physicians are giving people medication. I think mm-hmm. psychiatrists need to be doing it. And I have tried to go off of my medication many times, thinking, I feel fine. I don't need this. And generally, I think the longest I lasted was about a year, and I couldn't do it. And so I have had one episode of really feeling like I couldn't make it, and since my 1996 first diagnosis, but I take extraordinary care of myself. I've learned to do that. It's a hard thing to learn, but I have, whenever I start to feel that I'm sinking at all, I contact my therapist, my spiritual counselor, my doctor if I feel like I need a medication change. I did have medication stop working once. I was on Prozac, and it just stopped working. And the psychiatrist said, oh, yeah, that's known as the Prozac poop out. And I was like, help. You know, it was really scary. And then he switched me to Zoloft, which was the medication I was initially on. And so I figure, why mess with it? You know, I'm not going to ever change my medication again unless, you know, it stops working. But I will always take extraordinary care of my mental health. And I try to model that for my kids, you know. Mm-hmm. If they're having a rough time, I say, you know, the school counselor is really, really helpful. They're there for you. And you know, I think it's important that we as parents talk about these things, because you're going to have rough patches, and hopefully my kids won't have the extent that I did, but mm-hmm. you need to have no shame in reaching out for help. Absolutely none.
Well, that brings up a good point. You mentioned your kids, and as a mother of two girls, what do you share with your daughters about your struggle with depression?
Well, you know, they're still pretty young. They're 11 and 8. And so, you know, when they asked what the book was about, and we talked a lot about Bunker, my oldest daughter was 2 when he died. And he was her protector. And she, you know, at age, I think she was 7, she was at school and burst into tears. And the teacher said, what's wrong? And she said, I miss Bunker. And, you know, I think that they kind of understand, well, she in particular understands, you know, how extraordinary he was. But I talk to them and I say, you know, this was a time in my mommy's life when I was really sad, and I needed to figure out how to not be so sad and how to understand why I was so sad. And my oldest daughter said she was interested in reading the book, and so I said, how about I read it to you and you can ask me some questions. And we read about a half a chapter, and she's like, that was it, and she never asked to read anymore. And I was like, okay, good. I think it was hard. I think it was hard for her to hear that her mom was having a hard time. Mm-hmm. I think she's too young to really understand. But I'm really open with them and just say, you know, I got really sad, and I had to figure out a way to feel better, and it was really important. And so, you know, I teach them, if you're sad, like, first of all, it's okay to be sad. Mm-hmm. You know, there's too much in our culture of, you know, let's be happy and let's all, you know, look good and be happy and da 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 da. And actually, that's unrealistic. It's not going to work. And so I tell them, you know, you had a bad day. Oh, I'm so sorry you had a bad day. That sounds really hard. It's okay to be sad about that and frustrated. Of course you are, you know, not to deny them any feelings.
Well,
yeah.
I think it's beautiful that, you know, that you read some of it to your daughter, that at 11 years old, she may want to readdress that and know that you're open to it, that it's not something that, you know, that you're forbidding her to do. So I think that worked out quite well for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, as I'm looking on the time, and it has flown by, and I appreciate so much you taking this time with us. Are you working on anything else? Are you working on a new book? Is there anything else that we can look forward to?
Well, yes, I'm always writing. I'm always writing. And I don't exactly know what the next book is going to turn out to be, but it'll most likely be something similar, some kind of memoir, maybe essays-ish. I don't know. But Dog Medicine was, we just announced today that it was acquired by Penguin.
Oh,
and so
nice.
They're re-releasing it in July. And so the current edition is just going to sell until it's gone. We have until May 1st. So if you do want to get it now before it's gone, and then it'll be reissued in July.
And to get it, do they go to your website, or can they go to Amazon, or
Amazon. The best place is Amazon, because we've had a little bit of problems with other spots. So for now, the best place.
Okay.
After in July, go to your local independent bookstore.
That sounds great. Well, please let us know when the next one comes out. I would love to know more about it. I would love to have you back. But again, thank you so much for coming on and sharing on what I think is such a huge, huge topic that just doesn't get enough attention. And you know, and I love the way in which you've dealt with it, the way in which you've opened up. And again, as I mentioned to everybody in regards to the book, you know, if you are going through something, it's a great resource to read. But even if you're not, it really is a very a warm, heartfelt story that I think all of us can benefit from.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. And for everybody else out there, please tune in with us next week when our guest will be Betsy Chase, author of It Came Out of My Vagina, Now What? It's the hilarious truth about motherhood. And if you miss or want to share our show with your friends, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com, or you can also subscribe to us on iTunes, and it'll get sent to you after every show. And the next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and like us. Have a wonderful week. Be good humans. And thank you for listening to Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.